The Round Dozen, with Michael Williams and Joanna David, and Dirk Bogarde as the narrator.
I like Ilsham. It's a seaside resort in the south of England, not far from Brighton, and in the 1920s it shared something of Brighton's late Georgian charm. I don't know whether Ilsham was ever fashionable, but it was certainly respectable and cheap. Elderly ladies, maiden and widowed, lived there, retired soldiers and Anglo-Indians. One November, two or three years after the Great War, following a bad attack of influenza, I went down to Ilsham to regain my strength. I arrived in the afternoon, and when I had unpacked my things, I went for a stroll on the seafront. The sky was overcast and the calm sea grey and cold, and after a while, I sat down on one of those convenient benches and watched a figure advancing towards me from a distance. As he came nearer, I saw that it was a shabby little man walking along with his hands in his pockets. He gave me a glance as he passed by, went on a few steps, hesitated, stopped, and turned back.
Excuse me, sir, but could you oblige me with a light?
Oh, yes, certainly.
That is very kind of you. Oh, dear, dear me. How very annoying. I don't seem to have a cigarette left.
Let me offer you one. There you are. Now me.
No, you are very kind. Gold case. Don't use cigarette cases myself anymore. I've had three. All gold, all stolen. Are you making a long stay in Ilsham, sir?
About 10 days or a fortnight.
And is this your first visit?
No, I've been here before.
Oh, I know Ilsham well, sir. I flatter myself there are few seaside resorts that I have not been to at one time or another. Ilsham's hard to beat, sir. You get a very nice class of person here. There's nothing noisy or vulgar about Ilsham. It has very pleasant recollections for me. Oh, yes. I was married in St. Martin's Church, sir.
Really?
Oh, yes. And that one was a very happy marriage, sir.
I'm very glad to hear it.
Well, I mustn't keep you, sir. Pleased to have made your acquaintance.
He took off his dingy hat very politely and strolled away. It was beginning to grow chilly, so I made my way back to the hotel lounge for tea. I had a book with me, but after a while, my attention was drawn to a group of three people sitting close by in the bow window. The party consisted of an old gentleman and two ladies, one elderly and probably his wife, and one younger and, well, perhaps their daughter. The old lady wore a voluminous dress of black silk and was hung about with heavy gold jewellery that had gone out of fashion 30 years before. She was knitting. The younger woman, whom I first saw only in profile, seemed extremely beautiful until she turned her head. Then I saw with a shock that although wearing a dress suitable for a young lady in her 20s, she was so well beyond the bloom of youth that I would put her age at about 50.
Did you enjoy your walk this afternoon, Eleanor?
It was very nice, Aunt Gertrude.
And which direction did you take today?
I turned my back on the sea, Uncle Edwin. I struck out into the town. It was quite an adventure.
Indeed. When you have come to the end of your row, my dear, we might go for our drive. The landau will be here at any moment.
That will be very nice. If you're going upstairs, Eleanor, will you take my knitting?
Certainly, Aunt Gertrude.
I dare say you're a little tired after your walk, my dear.
I shall rest before dinner.
Curious to know who these singular people were, I passed the time of day with Miss Wilkins, the manageress.
Oh, you must mean Mr. and Mrs. St. Clair. They live in London. Bayswater, I think. Let me see. Yes, 68 Leinster Square. Mr. and Mrs. Edwin St. Clair and Miss Porchester. Miss Porchester's their niece, I believe. They started coming here just after the war. always out of season makes them specially welcome.
I'm sure it does, Miss Wilkins. But who is Mr. Sinclair, do you know?
Oh, something in the city, I believe. I don't really know much about them.
Come in. Yes, what is it?
Mr. Sinclair presents his compliments, sir. And could you oblige him with the loan of Whittaker's Almanac?
Whittaker's Almanac? Hmm. Why on earth should Mr. Sinclair think I have a Whittaker's Almanac?
Well, sir, Miss Wilkins told him you were a writer.
Oh, yeah. Would you please tell Mr. Sinclair that I'm very sorry that I haven't got a Whittaker's Almanac, but if I had, I would very gladly lend it to him. Here was my opportunity. This odd little family intrigued me. They seemed to belong to a bygone age, preserved, as it were, in aspic. How extraordinary that they could have lived through the past 40 years as though the world had stood still. I was filled with eagerness to know these strange persons more closely. Mr. Sinclair, I believe. Mm. I'm so sorry. I haven't got a Whittaker's Almanac. But if I have any other book that can be of service to you, I should be delighted to lend it to you.
Oh, it does not matter at all. But I was given to understand by the manageress that you were a novelist.
In days gone by,
Mr. Trollope often used to dine with us in Leinster Square, and I remember him saying that the two most useful books to a novelist were the Bible and Whittaker's Almanac.
Yes, I see. Speaking of novelists, I understand that Mr. Thackeray once stayed at this hotel.
I never very much cared for Mr. Thackeray, though he dined more than once with my wife's father. Did he not, my dear?
Indeed.
He was too cynical for me. My niece has not read Vanity Fair to this day. Is that not so, Eleanor?
Yes, Uncle.
Oh, perhaps, my dear, this gentleman would do us the pleasure to take his coffee with us?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Trollope was always my favourite novelist. He was so essentially a gentleman. I admire Charles Dickens, but he could never draw a gentleman. I'm given to understand that young people nowadays find Mr. Trollope a little slow. My niece, Miss Porchester, once persuaded me to read a novel by a Miss Rhoda Broughton, but I could not manage more than 100 pages of it.
I did not say I liked it, Uncle Edwin. I told you it was rather fast, but everybody was talking about it.
I'm quite sure it is not the sort of book your Aunt Gertrude would have wished you to read, Eleanor.
I remember Miss Broughton telling me once that when she was young, people said her books were fast, and when she was old, they said they were slow. And it was really very hard, since she'd written exactly the same sort of book for 40 years.
Oh, did you know Miss Broughton? How very interesting. And did you know Ouida?
My dear Eleanor, what will you say next? I'm quite sure you've never read anything by Ouida.
Indeed I have, Uncle Edwin. I've read Under Two Flags, and I liked it very much.
You amaze and shock me. I don't know what girls are coming to nowadays.
You always said that when I was 30, you gave me complete liberty to read anything I liked.
There is a difference, my dear Eleanor, between liberty and license.
Next morning, strolling through a pretty little lane at the back of Elsham, I met Miss Porchester, who was taking her walk. I should have liked to have gone a little way with her, but I felt certain that it would embarrass this maiden of 50 to saunter alone with a man, even of my respectable years. She bowed as I passed her and blushed. Oddly enough, a few yards behind her, I came upon the funny, shabby little man I'd spoken to briefly on the front. He touched his old bowler hat.
Excuse me, sir, but could you oblige me with a light?
Oh, certainly, but I'm afraid I have no cigarettes on.
Now, allow me to offer you one of mine. Oh, dear, dear. I haven't got one either. What a curious coincidence. Never mind. Excuse me, sir, but am I right in thinking that you are the well-known author?
I am an author, certainly, but what made you think of it?
I have seen your picture in the illustrated papers. Yeah, would you object very much, sir, if we sat down for a moment on this bench? I'm a wee bit tired.
Oh, yes, of course, no. By all means, do.
I suppose you don't recognise me.
I looked at him again. A weedy little man in neat but shabby black clothes with a long nose and watery blue eyes.
I'm awfully afraid I don't.
I dare say I've changed. There was a time when my photograph was in every paper in the United Kingdom. Of course, these press photos never do you justice. If I hadn't seen my name underneath, I should never have guessed that some of them were meant for me. Of course, you don't know who I am, sir, do you?
Oh, I'm afraid I
am the celebrated Mortimer Ellis.
Oh.
Mortimer Ellis? You're not going to tell me you don't know my name.
I'm sorry. I'm very often out of England.
That's fame for you. Why, for weeks, I was the most talked about man in England. I am the well-known bigamist. I've had 11 wives, sir.
11? Most people find one about as much as they can manage.
Ah, that's for want of practice. When you've had 11, there's very little you don't know about women.
But why did you stop at 11?
There, no, I knew you'd say that. 11 does seem a funny number. There's something unfinished about it. That's the one thing I regret. I shouldn't have minded anything if I could have brought it up to the round dozen. Allow me to show you my cuttings. As you see, I carry them with me at all times. There you are.
Catalogue of Heartbreak.
Deceiver preyed on women.
Scoundrel meets his Waterloo.
Not what you'd call a good press.
Oh, I never pay any attention to what the newspapers say. I've known too many journalists for that. No, it's the judge I blame. He treated me shocking.
Mortimer Ellis, the jury have found you guilty as charged, a verdict with which I am in complete agreement. Yours were a particularly despicable series of crimes. You set out to prey on innocent women, to deceive them about your real feelings towards them, and to trick them into undergoing a form of marriage. It is quite clear that your sole object was to gain control of what they owned. In my view, the ruthless and cold-blooded way you set about your career of fraud and deception leaves no room for excuses. You are a heartless scoundrel, and you will go to prison for a period of 5 years. Take him down.
Wicked, I call it. Look here. Three of his victims pleaded for mercy to be shown to him. That shows what they thought of me. And he still gave me 5 years. A heartless scoundrel, he called me. Me, the best-hearted man that ever lived.
May I look through these?
You certainly may, sir. I want you to. And if you can read them and say that I'm not very much wronged, well, you're not the man I took you for.
After my parents died, I continued to live in the family house in Eastbourne. Of course, it was far too big for just me, so I let off some of the upstairs rooms. Mr. Ellis happened to apply for one of them. He asked me to marry him within the fortnight. He was so gentle and considerate. We had a lovely time together.
I don't regret a moment. I'm not living in Worthing now. I couldn't face the neighbours, but I'd do it all again, even knowing what I know about him. He's a lovely man. He took everything I owned, but I wouldn't have missed it for worlds.
I see from this that you nearly achieved your round dozen.
That I did, sir. Miss Hubbard, as I recall. £2,000 in war loan. Littlehampton it was. They'd read the banns. Then one of my former wives happened to spot me in the town. She told the police. They arrested me on the day before my 12th wedding. She was a bad one, she was. She deceived me something cruel.
Yeah, what did she do?
Well, she led me to understand that she'd been in the millinery business and had retired with something like £1,500. When I married her, would you believe it, she hadn't got £300. And that's the one who gave me away.
But forgive me for asking, but why did they marry you?
Oh, that's quite simple. Because I asked them.
But did you never have any refusals?
Very seldom. Not more than 4 or 5 in the whole course of my career.
Well, I make no comment on your personal attraction.
My appearance puzzles you. You don't know what they see in me. That's what comes of reading novels and going to the pictures. Are you a married man, sir?
Yes, I am. But I only have one wife.
Well, you can't judge by that. You can't generalize from a single instance, if you know what I mean.
No, I suppose not.
No. Women don't really care about looks. I may not be handsome,
But I've got what every woman wants. And the proof is, I've made every one of my wives happy. What they want is a man who is serious. And then, attention. They crave attention. Some men can't be bothered with the little things that women like, but it's no difficulty to me. I never went out of the house without giving my wife a kiss, and I never came in without giving her another. And it was very seldom I came in without bringing some chocolates or a few flowers. I never grudged the expense.
After all, it was her money you were spending.
And what if it was? It's not the money that signifies. It's the spirit the present's given in. That's what counts with women. No, I'm not one to boast. But I will say this myself. I'm a good husband.
But all these women, they were very respectable, of a certain age, quite decent. And yet they married you without any inquiry on the shortest possible acquaintance.
And that's what you don't understand, sir. Women have got a craving to be married. It doesn't matter how young they are or how old or if they're short or tall, dark or fair. They've all got this one thing in common.
I see.
When it all came out, there was a rare to-do because I'd married 11 times. 11 times! I could have been married 30 times if I'd wanted to. I give you my word, sir, when I consider my opportunities, I'm astounded at my moderation. And I wondered if the judge, the jury, the public thought about my side of it at all. Did any of them think what I'd done for these women?
You took their money.
Of course I took their money. I had to live the same as anybody else. But what did I give them in exchange?
Well, do tell me.
Romance. That's what I gave them for their money. Look at this place. Elsham. There are 100 places in England like this. Sea, sky, lodging houses, front. Doesn't it make your heart sink? You're all right. You're just here for a week or so because you're run down. But think of all the women who live here from one year's end to another. They know hardly anyone. They've just got enough money to live on and no more. Their lives are endless, hopeless, and I give them love. Many of them had never known what it was to sit on a bench in the dark with a man's arm round their waist. I bring them change and excitement. I bring them a new pride in themselves. They were on the shelf, and I came along and took them down. 5 years they gave me. They should have given me the Medal of the Royal Humane Society.
Well, you certainly don't seem to have made much out of it all.
Bored and lodging, sir. But I was never able to save. Yeah, and the proof is that now, when I'm not so young anymore, I haven't got a half crown in my pocket. I was wondering, sir, if you might oblige me with a trifle. It's humiliating to have to ask, but if you could oblige me with £1, it would mean a great deal to me.
Mr. Ellis, you've afforded me a good pound worth of entertainment this morning, by all means.
I suppose you couldn't make that too, sir.
I think I could.
I am much obliged to you, sir.
There's one thing I should like to ask you.
Sir?
How on earth did you persuade these respectable and no doubt thrifty women to entrust you with all their savings?
Well, sir, you know what Shakespeare said about ambition o'erleaping itself. Tell a woman you'll double her capital in 6 months, and she won't be able to give you the money quick enough. Greed. That's what it is. Sheer greed.
It was a sharp sensation, stimulating to the appetite, like hot chocolate sauce with ice cream, to go from this diverting ruffian to the respectability or lavender bags and crinolines of the St. Clairs and Miss Porchester.
Miss Wilkins informed me that you write plays.
I have done so, certainly.
And have your plays been performed?
Yes, a couple of my pieces have been seen on the London stage, Miss Porchester, yes.
We often used to go to the theatre when Sir Henry Irving was at the Lyceum.
Oh, indeed.
Oh, yes. I once had the pleasure of meeting him. I was taken to supper at the Garrick Club by Sir Everard Millais, and I was introduced to Mr. Irving, as he was then.
Tell him what he said to you, Edwin.
You have the actor's face, Mr. St. Clair, he said to me. If you ever think of going on the stage, come to me and I will give you a part. It was enough to turn a young man's head.
My husband was very bohemian as a young man.
I sowed my wild oats. I knew quite a lot of painters and writers. Wilkie Collins, for instance. And even men who wrote for the papers. Watts painted a portrait of my wife, and I bought a picture from Millie. I knew a number of the pre-Raphaelites.
Have you a Rossetti?
No. I admired Rossetti's talent, but I could not approve of his private life.
I see.
I would never buy a picture by an artist whom I should not care to ask to dinner at my house.
Are you not going to read to us tonight, Uncle Edwin? Uncle Edwin reads to us every evening before we retire. We are at present in the midst of Bleak House.
Oh, I see. Well, in that case, I think I'll leave you, if I may. Private reading is essentially a family occasion. Good night, Miss Porchester. Mrs. Sinclair, good night, sir.
Good night. Good night to you.
It was while I was drinking a glass of port with Mr. Sinclair one evening, a practice which had become a ritual with us, that he told me the sad story of Miss Porchester.
She had been engaged to be married to a nephew of my wife's, a barrister, an excellent young man in every way. Or so we believed.
What happened?
It was discovered that he had had an intrigue with the daughter of his laundress.
An intrigue?
It was a terrible thing. Terrible. It goes without saying that my niece took the only possible course. She returned him his ring, his letters, and his photograph, and she told him that she could never marry him. She implored him to marry the young person he had wronged, and she said she'd be a sister to her. It broke her heart. She has never cared for anyone since. Another glass?
Yes, thank you. And did he marry the young person?
No, we were greatly mistaken in him. It has been a sore grief to my wife that a nephew of hers should behave in such a dishonourable manner.
What became of him?
Some time later we heard that he was engaged to a young lady with £10,000 of her own.
Oh.
I considered it my duty to write to her father and put the facts before him. He answered my letter in a most insolent fashion. He said he would much rather his son-in-law had a mistress before marriage than after.
What happened?
They were married. Now my wife's nephew is one of His Majesty's judges of the High Court, and his wife is my lady. But we've never consented to receive them. When my wife's nephew was knighted, Eleanor suggested that we should ask them to dinner. But my wife said that he should never darken our doors, and I upheld her.
And the laundress's daughter?
She married in her own class and has a public house at Canterbury. My niece, who has a little money of her own, did everything for her, and is godmother to her eldest child.
Poor Miss Porchester, sacrificed on the altar of Victorian morality. Her only satisfaction must be the consciousness that she behaved beautifully.
No, Miss Porchester never cared for anyone but her cousin. She never speaks of him, and it is now 30 years since they parted. But I'm convinced she loves him still. She is a true woman, my dear sir. One life, one love. And though perhaps I regret that she has been deprived of the joys of marriage and motherhood, I am bound to admire her fidelity.
Rash Uncle Edwin, for though you brought the orphaned Eleanor into your house when she was only a child, what, Uncle Edwin, when it comes down to brass tacks, do you really know of Eleanor?
Oh, thank goodness you're here, sir. Mr. St. Clair's compliments, and will you go up to number 27 the moment you come in?
Why, yes, of course, Miss Wilkins. Why? What's happened?
Oh, there's a rare upset. They'll tell you.
Come in.
I entered. I found Mrs. St. Clair lying on the sofa with a handkerchief soaked in eau de cologne on her brow and a bottle of smelling salts in her hand. Mr. St. Clair was standing in front of the fire in such a manner as to prevent anyone else in the room from obtaining any benefit from it.
I must apologise for asking you to come up in this unceremonious fashion, but we are in great distress, and we thought you might be able to throw some light on what has happened.
What has happened?
Our niece, Miss Porchester, has eloped.
Eloped?
This morning she sent in a message to my wife that she had one of her sick headaches. When she has one of her sick headaches, she likes to be left absolutely alone.
It wasn't until this afternoon that my wife went to see if there was anything she could do for her. The room was empty and her trunk was packed.
Had she left no word of explanation?
Oh, yes. On the pillow I found a letter telling us of her rash act.
I'm very sorry. I don't know exactly what I can do.
We were under the impression that you were the only gentleman at Elsham with whom she had any acquaintance.
Oh, good heavens, Mrs. Sinclair, I haven't eloped with her. If that's what you fear, I happen to be a married man.
I see that you haven't. I must admit, at the first moment we thought, perhaps... do forgive us, sir. It's such a mystery. If it isn't you, who is it?
I'm sure I don't know.
Show him this letter, Edwin.
Don't move, Gertrude. It will bring on your lumbago. There you are, sir. Read that.
Dearest Uncle Edwin and Aunt Gertrude, when you receive this...
I shall be far away. I'm going to be married this morning to a gentleman who is very dear to me. I know I'm doing wrong in running away like this, but I was afraid you would try to set obstacles in the way of my marriage. My fiancé is a very retiring man, and owing to his long residence in tropical countries, not in the best of health. He thought it much better that we should be married quite privately. When you know how radiantly happy I am, I hope you will forgive me. Please send my trunk to the luggage office.
At Victoria Station. Your loving niece, Eleanor.
I will never forgive her. Never. She shall never darken my doors again. Gertrude, I forbid you ever to mention Eleanor's name in my hearing.
Aren't you being rather hard, Mr. Sinclair? I mean, is there any reason why Miss Porchester shouldn't marry?
At her age? It's ridiculous. We shall be the laughingstock of Leinster Square. Do you know how old she is? She's 51.
54.
She's been like a daughter to us. I think it's positively improper for an old maid like her to think of marriage.
She was always a girl to us, Edwin.
And who is this man she's marrying? It's the deception that rankles. She must have been carrying on with him under our very noses. She doesn't even tell us his name. I fear the very worst.
Suddenly, I had an inspiration. That morning after breakfast, I'd gone out to buy myself some cigarettes. And at the tobacconist's, I ran across Mortimer Ellis. His boots had been repaired and were neatly blacked. His hat was brushed. He was wearing a clean collar and new gloves. Oh, Mr. Ellis. Good morning to you. I haven't seen you for some days. You're looking very spruce.
Good morning, sir. Yes, I have to go to London this morning. A matter of business.
Oh. Mr. Sinclair, I think you said that Miss Porchester had money of her own.
A trifle. She has £3,000.
£3,000, I see.
Edwin, supposing he doesn't marry her?
The disgrace would kill me.
You need have no fears on that score. None. He'll marry her, all right. He always does. He'll marry her in church.
They paid no attention. I suppose they thought I'd suddenly taken leave of my senses. But I was quite certain. Mortimer Ellis had achieved his ambition after all. Miss Porchester completed the round dozen.
In The Round Dozen by Somerset Maugham, Dirk Bogarde was the narrator, with Michael Williams as Mortimer Ellis and Joanna David as Eleanor Porchester. Dennis Hawthorne was Mr. Sinclair and Zulema Dean, Mrs. Sinclair. Others taking part were Jane Whittenshaw, Paul Jenkins and Stephen Crinchlow. The Round Dozen was dramatised by Neville Teller and directed by Janet Whittaker.